Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, April 24th, 2015. Barack Obama is the drone president. You never reach the sky. Now, Barack Obama did not initiate the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, but he widely expanded their use. And in doing so, he put a cloak of false secrecy over it. And we only know what they want us to know about the drone program, with a few exceptions of things that have leaked out or been released for particular reasons. And so this week, the president engaged in a Nixon-style limited hangout where he positioned himself as sharing all the information the American people need to know about drone strikes in mid-January that he says were inadvertently the cause of the deaths of an American and an Italian who were being held captive by the Taliban. And I say limited hangout for good reason, because in his initial comments, the president didn't give the date of the action. He didn't even specify exactly where it occurred. And they play all kinds of games with the selective release of information, but the overall secrecy that obscures much of what we do with drones. And so there are a lot of questions that have been prompted by the revelations. And first and foremost, where I start is, did the president have the authority to order drone strikes when they didn't even know who was present at the targeted locations? They use the term signature strikes for this type of attack. And they claim that there were hundreds of hours of surveillance over this location. They cross-checked with cell phone data. Then they decided to go ahead, and it wasn't until the rubble was unearthed that they found two extra bodies. And they tell us that it took them months to confirm that those were the bodies of American Warren Weinstein and the Italian hostage as well. They're also important questions because they used this opportunity to say, by the way, there was another drone strike, and we didn't know it at the time, but it killed two American citizens who have aligned with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. One is better known than the other, Adam Gadahn, G-A-D-H-A-N. He grew up here in California, in the south part of the state. And over the last few years, he made some videos. In the first few, he didn't show his face, and then he got more brazen. And it's fair to say that he has joined Al-Qaeda. We even went to the lengths of charging him with treason and providing material support to terrorists. But he was never tried for those charges, and there is no process in a court or elsewhere that we know of that led to his death. And by declaring it accidental, the United States kind of skips out of any scrutiny for whether these killings were consistent even with the very loose legal language that the Obama administration wrote for itself to legitimize, in its eyes, the targeted drone strike that killed Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen several years ago. And I'm a stickler for this. I don't think that you can just say that because somebody is joining Al-Qaeda, speaking up in support of what we call an enemy, that we have the right to kill them without any process whatsoever. And I want to really see some facts here to know that Adam Gadahn was not intentionally targeted and killed. And it's not because I have some great sympathy for Adam Gadahn. It is the constitutional rights that we hold dear We're told that the Constitution is what all these wars are about, right? To protect us from these evil terrorists who would impose Sharia law on us. Well, at some point, we've got to be consistent about these things. And frankly, I don't think we are, and most people don't seem to care. Now, maybe you know who Harold Koh is. He spells his last name K-O-H. He gained controversy during the Bush administration when he went public with some of his objections to policy. Obama appointed him to the State Department, where he helped author the memo that I referred to a moment ago that we are told legitimized the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki without any court proceedings, no conviction, no nothing. Well, Harold Koh has been in a really hot firestorm since he joined the faculty at New York University's School of Law. And in the show file for this podcast, I'm going to link to a blog that is written by law students at NYU that want the university to fire Harold Koh. They consider him to be the John Yoo of NYU. And John Yoo has actually come to Harold Koh's defense recently. But I won't go into the details of it, but this blog that I'm referring to will show you the shifting positions of Harold Koh. Nonetheless, he is demanding that the Obama administration release what he calls a factual record of what occurred here. And he is joined in that call by Christopher Swift, who's quoted in the Guardian story here, a professor of national security studies at Georgetown. Now, Swift says he thinks the strikes appear legal. He says it's not the platform, the drones, it's whether it was unlawful killing. If it's completely accidental as it appears, then it's a horrible tragedy. It's not necessarily an unconstitutional undertaking. Now, to be fair, he's referring to the death of Warren Weinstein and the Italian Laporto. Now, Swift goes on to challenge the argument that was inferred by Obama that these people posed imminent threats, and therefore, because we claim we were unable to capture them, that we are permitted to just slay them. And Swift goes on to say, the DOJ memorandum's approach to imminence makes a mockery of the concept. He says, if you don't have imminence, you'd have to show that you'd have due process. And I think that's a very important point that has been widely abused. But the issue really remains about signature strikes. And that President Obama can on the one hand say that, you know, we bend over backwards to avoid killing civilians, and then acknowledge that we didn't know who was at the targeted location when we pulled the trigger. Well, thousands of people, by some estimates, thousands of innocent people have been killed by our drone strikes. And that's why I led yesterday's podcast with that question. Obama regrets killing an American and an Italian, but he doesn't seem to regret innocent civilians, and he explicitly doesn't regret killing Adam Gadahn. The White House has assured us of that. Now, much of what we see in our world, in our country today, is driven by fear. Fear of the Islamic State, fear of Ebola. And a lot of these fears are misplaced. A lot of them are concocted. And prompted by a blog post that he wrote earlier this week, I did an in-depth interview today with Dr. Justin Frank. He's the author of Bush on the Couch, and more recently, Obama on the Couch. And we, in a dialogue manner, go through a lot of recent events and try to separate reality from the kind of concocted fear that is often projected by government and media, and that leads to, the passage of an unamended extension to the Patriot Act. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Dr. Justin Frank.
I think that what's so amazingly interesting about what you're saying is the immediacy with which the fear can be brought home through television and through kind of personal bombardment, because certainly William Randolph Hearst understood the power of fear when he invented, or what was called, yellow journalism over 100 years ago, when he wrote about invasions and the Spanish-American War in 1898. There were all kinds of fears whipped up by the Hearst newspapers then during World War One, and there were like headlines, the sinking of the Lusitania, which I understand, but I mean, there was a constant fear, a fear of communism. There's a long history in this country. That's why we have wide open spaces. It's why this country was, you know, based on people sort of needing space originally. So you're right. I mean, I agree with you completely, and it's just getting more and more. The question is what to do about it psychologically, because fear is part of human nature, and the question is how do you deal with turning fear into a source of information rather than a source of cowering, or a source of something that leads you to abdicate your responsibility and your ability to think and allow other people to do your thinking for you. And the media certainly wants to get ratings up, and they want to sell papers, and they want to get, you know, ads going, and so they're going to try to get a bigger audience. So they use fear very quickly, and people like President Bush and other people in politics know how to stoke those fears.
You can hear the full conversation with Dr. Justin Frank. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And subscribers include people like Terry Paris, Cheryl Fleming, Dick Attlee, and Andy Bettmanis. I want to thank each and every one of you and invite those who never hear your name mentioned here to come on over to peterbcollins.com. Will you become a subscriber? I'd really appreciate it. I need your help. You go to my website under my picture. There's a link that says sign up under my picture. On the next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. The bonus gift for new annual subscribers is Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos. I'll be happy to send you the e-book edition. And in my conversation with Dr. Frank, one of the things I highlighted was the incredible hysteria that was stoked by the media and irresponsible people last year about the risk of an Ebola outbreak in the United States. It was completely preposterous. And one of the things that I didn't get to mention in my conversation with Dr. Frank is that the U.S. mobilization last August and September into West Africa cost us nearly $2 billion. And our military was there. They built 11 Ebola treatment centers. 9 of those centers have never seen a single patient. So not only was our response way too late, but we squandered money for PR purposes on clinics, and I can't tell you if they were in the wrong location or just that the epidemic had peaked and was starting to sharply decline when those facilities opened. But it's just another example of how fear caused us to respond in ways that really don't make any sense when you look closely at them. Well, we'll see how this weekend turns out on the Mediterranean. Last weekend was deadly. Over 1,000 people, refugees, died attempting to cross the Mediterranean. And European officials have announced that they are tripling the amount of money that they're spending, but it's still a very minimal effort. Experts in non-governmental organizations say the problem scale has not been addressed. And currently, there are a handful of ships and only 65 people who are deployed with 2 helicopters, 2 aircraft, and 6 coastal patrol boats. But they're only patrolling within 10 or 15 miles of the coasts of Italy and Malta. And the serious problems have been closer to Libya. So we'll see if that changes over the next few days and weeks. On Tuesday, the Saudis told us they were suspending their airstrikes in Yemen, but they have not let up, and today was no exception. They continue to pound the Houthi rebel positions, but the Houthis appear to be holding their own. According to an account by the Associated Press, the rebels and their allies have lost little ground despite the airstrikes, with Houthis controlling the north and the capital of Sana'a, while trying to make inroads in the southern and central provinces. And this AP story repeats the false notion that we debunked yesterday with the great reporting of Gareth Porter. It says, Western governments and the Sunni Arab countries in the coalition say the Houthis get their arms from the Shiite powerhouse Iran. Tehran and the rebels deny that. But obviously they're floating this to leave the impression that that's true. And as Gareth Porter reported yesterday, these arms were in a stash held by the former strongman Saleh, and he helped rearm the Houthis over the past 6 months. It's a risky move, but in response to a plea from the new prime minister in Iraq, the United States is mulling the idea of allowing Iraqi troops to call in airstrikes by U.S. warplanes. And this is something that the U.S. completely avoided during the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And the real reason for that is that we don't want to allow one side to use the United States to kill the other side in the ongoing conflict between Shia and Sunni. But because we don't want to put ground forces in there, and because we want to continue to fight from the air, we are looking for ways to guide our aircraft, and this appears to be one that is under consideration. This week, we've seen quite a few commemorations of the events of 100 years ago, when the Ottoman Empire was crumbling and modern-day Turkey was emerging at the expense of the Armenians. The estimate is that 1.5 million Armenians were killed, and we've seen a lot of squabbling over whether or not that was genocide. And as someone who doesn't have a stake in this struggle, it's easy for me to say, sure, it was genocide. And we've seen the Turks, pushing back on the Pope for using the term genocide. They've been able to scuttle resolutions in Congress that would simply acknowledge this event as a genocide. And the Times today reports something that I had not considered. It says, behind the Turkish government's denials of the century-old Armenian genocide lurks the possibility that survivors and their descendants could be deemed legally entitled to financial reparations. So Turkey is squirming about this because they fear that somehow, some way, they might be ordered to pay billions in reparations? Well, the article goes on to note that there's no judicial mechanism that exists in which claims of such magnitude from 100 years ago could be litigated. But that appears to be at least one of the concerns that drives the Turks into this bizarre position of, trying to deny the use of a term that doesn't even really... It's not used to describe the Turkish government, it's used to describe, as I said, the remnants of the Ottoman Empire. I don't get it still. In Chile, dramatic eruptions from the Calbuco volcano in southern Chile. I don't know if you've seen the pictures on television, but it is very impressive. So far, no injuries reported, but it is a huge, huge natural event. Our listener and staunch supporter, Faith Peoples, yesterday emailed me about the case of Freddie Gray, who died while in custody in Baltimore. And I have to conclude that the cover-up by the cops, at least so far, is holding. Because after almost a week of coverage, What we've seen is that we don't know when Freddie Gray received his fatal spine injury. They're saying his spinal cord was nearly 80% severed. Now, we know he was roughed up when they chased him down and arrested him. And it appears he was put into this van, first with leg shackles, and then they said he was being too agitated or something like that, and they handcuffed him. But the only detail that's leaked out is that they did not put a seatbelt on him. And one of the tricks the cops have used over the years is to put somebody in the back of a van or a paddy wagon and then just drive crazy, because cops are allowed to do that, right? And let them bounce all over the place in the back of the van. It's called the nickel ride in a paddy wagon. Did Freddie Gray get a nickel ride? Is that how his spine was severed that led to his death? Or was it direct blows from the cops who took him down? In any case, the cover-up is holding for now, and I hope that doesn't last. I was really shocked to read this, and shocked in a nice way. Nebraska is one of those states with a unicameral legislature. I think it's the only one in the union. So they have a single house. It's dominated by Republicans. There's a Republican governor named Pete Ricketts. Nonetheless, state lawmakers approved Bill 268 last week, which would replace the death penalty with life without parole. The vote was 30-13, which is enough to overcome a veto, which has been threatened by the governor. So it appears that the Republicans in the legislature will prevail, and that Republicans will preside over the elimination of the death penalty in Nebraska. I just never thought that would happen. Confirming speculation that we have been offering here for months, the U.S. Geological Survey and its counterpart in the state of Oklahoma, the Oklahoma Geological Survey, have both firmly concluded that the increasing spate of earthquakes in the state of Oklahoma is directly related to energy extraction. Now, where they quibble from the common notion that I've been advancing is that they claim that fracking is not the primary cause. But I think that they are splitting hairs and parsing words carefully to try to protect the fracking industry. That's just my speculation on that. Because this account from the New York Times: hydraulic fracturing, a drilling technique that injects a high-pressure mix of water and chemicals into the ground to break rock formations and release gas, has drawn widespread attention. But injecting water to dispose of waste from drilling or production is a far greater contributor to earthquakes. The federal report excluded human activity like mining that can cause quakes, but does not involve large-scale fluid injection. Well, I'm not a scientist. But from everything I know about fracking, the issue is the injection of water and chemicals in that cocktail, and then the disposal of the tainted fluids after they have been pumped underground. And because the tainted fluids are toxic, they're trying to put them underground in ways that won't bleed over into water sources, aquifers that humans use for farming or for consumption. And so I'll try to track down some experts and learn more about this. But I think that they are acknowledging that fracking and other forms of aggressive oil exploration are producing the earthquakes in places that have never had earthquakes before. And at least that is some progress. This one caught my eye as well. Not as shocking as banning the death penalty, but Chinese officials are opening a new campaign to crack down on strip teases and other lewd shows that have become popular at funerals in some rural areas. Huh? We call them a celebration of life sometimes when you go to a funeral, but I've never seen somebody strip naked there. They tell us that such erotic performances at funerals are a relatively new phenomenon. Many rural people believe that a large attendance at funerals is a sign of honor for the deceased, and if you have strippers, a lot of people will show up, huh? And finally, today, I'm happy to report that what we used to call the Waldo Tunnel, that many people call the Rainbow Tunnel, it takes you through the hillside just north of the Golden Gate Bridge, and it is arguably the gateway to Marin County, California. And yesterday, the lower house of the legislature unanimously approved a bill to rename the Waldo Rainbow Tunnel for Robin Williams. And I'll acknowledge that I've met a lot of celebrities, known some over the years, and I didn't know Robin Williams that well, but I met him and interviewed him several times. And more than most celebrities who have died, even those who took their own lives, I really still feel a great loss at the passing of Robin Williams. So we'll give Roy Rogers the day off today and wrap up with this one.
I'd like to do for you right now. This is Elmer Fudd sings Bruce Springsteen.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio. I pull you a little closer. You say no. You say you don't like it. I say you're a liar. But when we get, it's like fire.